Good morning. Our first case today is United States against Sanders. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Morning, Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court. During sentencing, the military judge abused her discretion in admitting a letter over defense counsel's objection. This letter was neither evidence of rehabilitative potential nor evidence in aggravation as defined by RCM 1001. Furthermore, the military judge did not conduct an MRE 403 balancing test on the record, and therefore her ruling should receive no deference by this honorable court. The military judge did state that the whole purpose that I will give this document really goes towards rehabilitative potential. However, the letter doesn't fall under evidence the government may present as rehabilitative potential pursuant to RCM 1001B5. In relevant part, the RCM provides that the prosecution may present by testimony evidence in the form of opinions concerning an accused's previous performance as a service member and potential for rehabilitation. But this letter wasn't testimony, and it didn't provide any such opinion on rehabilitative potential. Now, the government argues that the letter is admissible because it expresses a lack of remorse, citing to United States versus Edwards. However, Edwards simply stands for the proposition that once a foundation has been laid, that is, the accused has either testified or provided an unsworn statement, then trial counsel is permitted to comment.
Let's say you're correct on all counts. The letter is completely worthless. It has no value as aggravation, rehabilitation, rebuttal, foundation, or anything else. How do you demonstrate prejudice in a judge alone trial?
Well, this error influenced the judge's sentence because of the defense's substantial sentencing case. These were serious offenses. However, Sergeant Saunders provided testimony, or in his sentencing case, had his wife testify as well as his father. And in that testimony, his wife provided substantial mitigating evidence, namely...
Right, but how does that demonstrate that a useless document was prejudicial in a judge alone case? You're saying the fact that this had no aggravating information in a rehabilitative purpose, nonetheless, it swayed the judge to do something?
Well, Your Honor, the judge specifically stated she would consider this evidence.
As potential of rehabilitation, which way does that cut?
Well, I think it cuts against her decision to consider it at all.
No. Which way does that cut with regard to the appellant? If she's considering it with regard to rehabilitative potential, that seems to imply that she thought it had some value in his favor.
Well, the trial counsel argued a lack of rehabilitative potential based upon this letter. So we can infer from that argument and the military judge's statement that she would specifically consider.
Did he argue a lack of potential or did he argue a lack of remorse?
He argued a lack of remorse, which has been equated to a lack of rehabilitative potential.
Now, your main argument on aggravation is it doesn't directly relate to the offense or result from it. Is that correct? I mean, that's just parroting the case law. But question, the letter talks about the fact that she's now going to have to, the wife is now going to have to raise the boys alone and so on. Why is that not a result of the offense? Do you follow the question?
I do, Your Honor. That's not an aggravating circumstance.
I'm asking. You're supposed to tell me why that. I mean, I'm happy with whatever answer you give. I'm just asking you what's your response to that?
To whether or not that particular statement.
Why isn't that a resulting from the offense?
Well, I think it results from his conviction, but it's not an aggravating circumstance under the way that has been ferreted out in the case law and under the RCM, if I'm understanding your question correctly.
You can, if you want to amend your answer, you can certainly do so on rebuttal.
Is your point that it's never an aggravating circumstance, or is that it was not presented as an aggravating circumstance in this case?
That it was not presented as such in this case.
Well, in aggravation, one of the things we look at is what harm it has caused. And I think the question is here, the fact that these children, he won't be around to raise his children, is harmful. Is there a relationship there under the theory of aggravation that harm was caused by the offense? And if so, is that a proper thing for us to consider?
Well, Your Honor, I hadn't thought about it in that way before. It certainly does derive from the conviction, his absence from his family. However, whether or not that's an appropriate thing, as Judge Efron, as I answered in his question, it wasn't presented as such in this case. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there's no indication that the military judge considered it in that respect either. Whether or not it's appropriate.
I think you've done a good job by being candid and saying you actually haven't thought about it. I would invite you to think about it and say something on rebuttal. If you're welcome, then you can have sort of a chance to really compose your answer.
How do we deal with a situation on appeal, assuming that this is the case, where the prosecution presents evidence for use in a particular fashion on sentencing, and the judge says that he or she will use the information on that subject, and then the Court of Criminal Appeals says, well, we're going to consider it for something else, that is rehab. They're discussing, in this case, rehab. Is that what they were discussing at trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the Court of Criminal Appeals decided that they would consider it for what purpose?
The Court of Criminal Appeals said it was clearly evidence in aggravation.
Now, how do we then assess that in terms of, if, assuming it's error on rehabilitation and assuming it's permissible on aggravation, how do we determine whether the permissible use on aggravation would save the case for the government if the record indicates that it was not used for aggravation, either in trial counsel's argument or in the judge's statement as to how it would be admitted? What does the case law tell us about that? I'm trying to figure out, can admissibility on sentencing, when sentencing has particular buckets into which evidence can be placed, and the judge places it in one bucket and considers it in that fashion, and on appeal, the Court of Criminal Appeals says, well, it can be used for something else. If the judge is the sentencing authority, and there's no indication that the judge used it for the purpose that the Court of Criminal Appeals said, is it or is it not proper to consider it for the purposes that the Court of Criminal Appeals relied on?
My answer, Your Honor, is no. What the court should
be. But why? What's the legal rationale for, mm-hmm. for the no?
What this court is to look at is the military judge's decision to admit the evidence. And in this case, this military judge admitted the evidence based on rehabilitative potential. That decision.
How is that different from a case in which, let's say, the judge admits hearsay evidence based on present sense impression, and that's an incorrect decision, but the evidence is admissible under another hearsay exception, let's say, medical treatment? We typically say, well, came, you know, even though the judge cited the wrong rule, it nonetheless was admissible, so it comes in. How do you distinguish that admissibility issue from the use issue that we're talking about here?
If I may, Your Honor, address that and move on.
Please, thank you.
Having touched on rehabilitative potential and evidence and aggravation, I'd just like to touch upon the military judge's failure to do a 403 balancing test on the record.
Was a 403 objection lodged?
No, Your Honor. There was.
Is 403 a brooding omnipresence in the sky that a judge always has to spread on the record, regardless of whether an objection is lodged?
Well, in this case, yes, because to admit evidence in sentencing in aggravation, the court has said that it required, there are two limitations, one that is directly related and one that it passes a 403 balancing test.
Counsel, which portion of the letter would you think needed to be subjected to a 403 balancing test? Wouldn't it be the comments about the military judge, that the military judge said specifically that would not be considered?
Well, that's not a reach.
Yes, is it there? But there were also comments
Holmes,
Southern that Pacific. Related to the prosecutor and other people, although it didn't state which people, but there was evidence of comments that related to the prosecutor as well as people engaged in the military justice process, namely this court martial.
Didn't the judge say she wasn't going to place any weight on the aversions cast on her in this letter?
On her specifically, but nothing about the female prosecutor, the small town justice, or the false truths told by.
Do you think that that leaves open the possibility that the judge considered it for the female prosecutor and small town justice purposes while eschewing it for herself? That's drawing a pretty fine line, isn't it?
The record seems to draw that line, Your Honor, by just her stating, I'm not going to consider it for the comments you made against me.
But all of those comments, though, including the ones related to small town justice and the female prosecutor, were all intertwined with the comments about the military judge, counsel.
Yes, they were, Your Honor.
Just to clarify in my mind, the issue that's before us, at trial, there were issues raised about authentication and the origin of the document. For purposes of this particular appeal, though, am I correct in that those are not at issue anymore? That is, we have a document before us, which, under the record before us, we would presume was issued by the accused and the appellant and found in his cell, and it was attributable to him. Is that the posture that we're in on appeal round? I'm not asking you to concede that for whatever collateral purposes the defense might otherwise want to make of it, but for purposes of the issue now before us, is that where we are?
For purposes of the issue granted before this court, yes.
Thank you.
I'd just like to finally note that, additionally, the failure for the military judge to conduct the 403 balancing, the weak probative value that it did have because of the lack of foundation that was provided, and essentially this was a letter to his family. It was nice stuff about his family. It was sentiments to his wife and his children and his parents, and not any sort of refusal to take responsibility. There are no further questions from this court.
Thank you, counsel. You have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, I am Major Jeremy Weber, and along with Mr. Gerald R. Bruce, I represent the United States government in this case. The granted issue in this case asks whether the military judge erred by admitting irrelevant and highly prejudicial evidence in violation of RCM 1001 and Military Rule of Evidence 403. Now, in our brief, we've addressed some of appellant's related issues or objections to the admission of this evidence concerning whether it's proper aggravation evidence, whether it's proper evidence concerning his rehabilitative potential, and whether it was properly authenticated and identified. Subject to this court's questions, I would like to focus on the granted issue for this oral argument, whether the danger of unfair prejudice contained in Prosecution Exhibit 15 substantially outweighs its probative value. Now, Prosecution Exhibit 15, of course, was a letter that appellant wrote to his wife while in confinement immediately after he was found guilty on three charges of abusing local prostitutes. The letter contained little danger of unfair prejudice in this judge-alone trial, and what danger it did present of unfair prejudice, the military judge specifically recognized and dealt with.
Why is it probative of anything? Because it's obviously a letter to the spouse and sort of a, it's not, there's nothing that indicates that it was a letter to the world or anything other than that. It's sort of saying, sorry, spouse, I blew it or whatever. It's trying to amend his relationship with his wife or whatever. I don't even know what to describe what one does when they're going away for 17 years. But the 403 has probosity as one of the factors. Why is this probative?
Your Honor, the comments that you cite, I would say, have probative value as to his positive rehabilitative potential. The fact that he specifically states that, you know, apologized to his wife for the predicament that she's in, you know, recognizes the contributions that she's made, purportedly forgives his victims, recognizes the role God has played in his life, and so forth. Now, obviously, that's not the reason trial counsel presumably introduced this letter. On the flip side of that, it evidenced his lack of rehabilitative potential in that he expressed not only a lack of remorse, but
that's what he's talking to his wife here.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor, but the fact that he's talking to his wife, sort of talking to his wife in a quasi-letter, quasi-last will and testament, is still indicative of his lack of rehabilitative potential. His own feelings about the military judge, his own feelings about the crimes of which he had just been found guilty, his own feelings about the victims that he had just been found guilty of abusing.
Yeah, I understand the argument. Well, is it aggravating or not that he's left his two sons without a father?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that that in and of itself is an aggravating circumstance.
And why not? Because they're not the victims of the offense, or because it doesn't result from the offense, or why?
I would say because they're not the victims of the offense. I mean, certainly, his not being there for his family directly resulted from his offenses, but that they were not.
But you don't wish to push this argument as the government?
No, Your Honor.
Counsel, this letter, is there any indication this letter was delivered to the spouse, delivered to anybody?
There is no indication of that.
So for purposes of the record before us, is this a desk drawer letter? That is, he's blown off steam, he's got it in writing, and that's all we have before us. There's no indication that it was provided to any other person, is there?
I think what we have to, I believe there is, Your Honor, and I think we have to look at the letter itself and the record of trial surrounding that letter to glean that. The letter, it's clear from the actual verbiage in the letter that it was written on the night that he was found guilty. The court had adjourned for the evening after the findings of guilt. They were going to pick up the next morning in sentencing. In the letter itself, he references the findings of guilt. He, of course, titles it a last will and testament that is presumably supposed to be read by others. Then, instead of picking up the next morning, the trial picks up for just a minute. They reference that appellant was absent, that he was in some sort of mental health program, and then the trial was delayed by several days. When it then again reconvened, in his unsworn statement, appellant himself references his suicide attempt. So I don't think it's just a desk drawer letter. I think this was intended to be read by others.
Well, when someone writes a letter and puts it in the desk drawer, they intend at that point is to send it to others, but they're thinking about whether they'll actually go through with that. Is there any indication in this record that this letter was provided to anyone else by appellant as opposed to being seized? And I'm not getting into privacy issues or Fourth Amendment issues, but is there any indication that this letter was anything other than seized by the government?
No, Your Honor, there's no evidence of it.
And so is this situation any different than if the appellant was sitting around muttering in his cell, thinking that he was all alone, and someone happened to overhear him say the same things?
I believe it's decidedly different in that he intended to communicate the language in that letter through his suicide, and then having it provided as a last will and testament.
Counsel, without meaning to distract you from your argument, let's go back to the question that Judge Baker asked appellant's counsel at the beginning, and let's assume that we agree with the appellant that this letter was completely irrelevant. Can you please explain, as best you can, why it nonetheless is not prejudicial, either because it's a completely useless letter, or because the severity of the offenses, or because of the use made of it in the sentencing argument, et cetera, et cetera?
Exactly, Your Honor. I'm assuming that it had no probative value, or that it has such little probative value that it was substantially outweighed by whatever risk of unfair prejudice that this letter presented, then there can be no prejudice in this case to appellant. Of course, we assert that it was proper aggravation evidence, if for no other reason, in that it evidenced his hostility toward women.
That's the very portion of the letter that the military judge said she wasn't going to consider, and that's a very portion of the letter that I think is weakest in terms of if she had considered it, I think it would be pretty gosh darn prejudicial.
Exactly. Had she considered it under RCM 1001B4, as that specifically allows, as evidence that he selected his victims because of their gender, because of his hostility toward women, then the appellant would have been in a much worse position
But do you understand you can't have it both ways? I mean, she can't both say she doesn't consider any of this stuff with respect to her, and for you to argue now today that it was aggravating because it shows his hostility towards women.
Well, on the prejudice aspect, I believe we can, Your Honor, because had she considered it as she was allowed to under RCM 1001B4, then appellant would have been in a much worse situation than had she just ignored those comments and taken it for whatever rehabilitative potential it had. Setting that issue aside, though, Your Honor, let's say that it had very little probative value. Let's say it couldn't have been introduced under, you know, any of the RCMs, or it should have been excluded under MRE 403, then there can be no prejudice to appellant. For one thing, I mean, appellant is alleged, the only prejudice appellant is alleging here, the only unfair prejudice that this letter presented was the comments about the military judge, that these were so personal to her that she could not have lived up to her word, that she said she would totally ignore them, and she could not do that. Well,
I think that that's not correct. I think that the appellant also argues that she said that she was going to consider this improperly admitted evidence with respect to his rehabilitative potential, and that therefore whatever was in the letter was prejudicial.
My read of the record, Your Honor, is that she said, I will ignore, and then she said, I will totally ignore those comments. She said that I recognize that they were written at a very low point in your life, And then she said the whole purpose of the letter, not those comments, but the letter in total, goes to rehabilitative potential, whether that's positive or negative.
So the judge ignored what the defense has on page 13 and 14 of their brief, that is the trial counsel's argument that these were attacks on the female prosecutor and that they were inflammatory and improper for the judge to consider. Now, I'm not asking you to concede that they were improper, but the questioning right now goes to the question that assuming that they're improper, why isn't there prejudice from that?
Well, if I as I understand the appellant's argument, it's that the military judge could not live up to her word to ignore those comments.
Did the judge say that she was going to ignore the comments that involved an attack on the female prosecutor?
She did not. She said that she would ignore the comments toward herself. I'm not sure that there's any unfair prejudice in admitting statements about a female prosecutor.
Well, counsel, I'm a little confused because the only comment that I see about a female prosecutor is one that says the judge made her decision prior to the trial. She constantly remained in eye contact with the female prosecutor. This is small town justice. Is there any other comment involving the prosecutor that doesn't also involve the military judge?
No, Your Honor. You're exactly right. All the comments are tied toward the military judge herself. And again, the military judge said that she would specifically ignore those comments.
So the trial counsel mischaracterized the record in the trial counsel's argument, in which the trial counsel said that the comments were directed at the female prosecutor and that these are comments of a sexual predator who has shown that he has contempt for women through his own words and the crimes he has committed. Trial counsel error in that characterization of the record. That's on page 13, quote on page 13 and 14 of the defense brief. That's what they're relying on.
I just see that as a characterization of the evidence before them. I mean, it certainly references the female prosecutor. The thrust of the comments seem to be aimed at the military judge, though, that because of her identification with the prosecutor, because of their gender, that the military judge somehow was not fair. Now, let's assume that these comments were so inflammatory, so personal to the military judge, that she simply could not ignore them. But one would have expected, had this really been the dynamic at trial, that the appellant would have moved to disqualify the military judge. These were certainly able civilian defense counsel representing appellant who certainly made a number of motions at trial, certainly were aware of their right to do so, and chose not to move to disqualify the military judge, further evidencing that they perceived no real risk of unfair prejudice here, not to mention the fact that they did not specifically articulate a 403 objection.
And where in the defense brief does the defense rely on the attacks on the military judge as the basis for its request for relief in this case? Where does the defense say that the judge couldn't be relied on to adhere to her statement that she would ignore it? It may be in there.
Just a moment.
On page 12 and 13, the defense notes that and then says that the judge said she was going to totally ignore the comments against her. She didn't say that she was going to ignore appellant's other harsh comments. So it may be in here, but I didn't see where the defense was relying on the comments about the military judge as its basis for prejudice in this case. It noted it in the defense noted in the course of the description, but I didn't see that as a legal argument they were making.
I guess I would just point out that, I mean, they've cited to, you're right, they cite basically to the letter and the trial counsel's comments about the letter. The thrust of the comments in the letter, to me, seem to indicate that they're aimed at the military judge. And, of course, the military judge, reviewing that, you know, perceived that any risk of unfair prejudice was aimed at the comments toward her.
Right.
Just the way.
But my question is, where does the defense say that the judge did not follow through on her promise in that regard?
I don't think they specifically say that. I think that's just a fair inference of the argument that, you know, if 403 was somehow, you know, violated here, that the military judge couldn't have lived up to her word because Obviously, she recognized the danger of unfair prejudice and dealt with that.
I'd like to ask you the same question I asked the defense, assuming without conceding that the evidence should not have been admitted on rehab and the evidence was properly admitted under aggravation, could have been admitted under aggravation, as the Court of Criminal Appeals said. Is it proper for a case to be affirmed on those grounds when the use for aggravation is not apparent in the record, and what's apparent in the record is that it was used for rehab purposes?
I would simply point to United States versus Gogas for that proposition. In that case, of course, the issue at trial was, and the military judge admitted it as evidence of rehabilitative potential, that when it came up to CAF viewed it and said, we're not going to reach the issue of whether it's properly, a letter from appellant about the proceedings was proper rehabilitative potential evidence. They simply found that it was proper aggravation evidence.
Was aggravation not at issue at trial on that evidence?
I don't believe that it was, at least not from my reading of okay. the CAF opinions.
If you have evidence that's admitted solely for purposes of cross-examination or impeachment, which we sometimes have in the case of a confession, that's otherwise inadmissible. And can that evidence then be used to support findings?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If you have, let's take a case in which evidence is admitted solely for purposes of impeachment, and the judge instructs that it's only admissible for purposes of impeachment. Let's say, can the Court of Criminal Appeals then say, well, that evidence was also admissible on findings, and even though the judge didn't say that, we're going to rely on that evidence to support the findings in this case, even though the judge would have instructed the members that they can only use it for purposes of impeachment. Can a case be affirmed on that basis?
Under the prejudice analysis, Your Honor, I don't believe so. I mean, I think if the evidence itself would not have been admissible for findings, then
now, let's say that it would have been admissible for findings as a matter of law, but the judge did not admit it for purposes of findings. The judge admitted it only for purposes of impeachment. If the judge, as the fact finder, did not consider it for purposes of findings, can the Court of Criminal Appeals now affirm on the basis that the Court of Criminal Appeals will use it for findings?
I see, Your Honor. I think they can. I mean, had the military judge done what he or she could have done, then the appellant would have been in a worse situation at trial. So as part of the prejudice analysis, yes, Your Honor, I think that the Court can consider that. I would also note that on the prejudice prong here, certainly the nature of the crimes that appellant was convicted of, just standing alone, warrant the sentence that he received. Over a one-month period in the summer of 2004, he punched one woman in the face, he beat another and dragged her into his car, where he digitally penetrated her and threatened her before she was able to escape. He forcibly sodomized a third woman with a plastic grocery store bag as a makeshift condom.
You're making the argument that there is no prejudice in light of the nature of the crimes.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think you've made your point, haven't you?
Yes, Your Honor. On the issue of the 403 balancing test and what level of deference should be granted to the military judge, of course, our standards of review are well established. The government's position is that at the minimum, the judge ought to receive the middle ground, the less deference, in light of the fact that defense counsel did not articulate a 403 objection, in light of the fact that the military judge specifically recognized the possible danger of unfair prejudice in this case. She recognized, at least to some extent, what its probative value was. While she didn't say the words 403, while she didn't say the words substantially outweigh, she clearly had the 403 balancing test in her mind and therefore should receive less deference as opposed to no deference. Of course, if she received no deference, the government would assert that, as this court does its own review of the probative value versus prejudicial effect or danger of unfair prejudice, that this court can be confident that the 403 test was satisfied here. If there are no other questions, may I briefly conclude? Concerning the granted issue in this case, the military judge did not err by admitting Prosecution Exhibit 15 in violation of RCM 1001 and Military Rule of Evidence 403, as the danger of unfair prejudice contained in Prosecution Exhibit 15 was not substantially outweighed by its probative value. The letter was written in appellate's own words and handwriting. It detailed his lack of remorse, his contempt for women, along with other characteristics exhibiting his positive rehabilitative potential. The military judge appropriately recognized both the probative value and danger of unfair prejudice, and therefore the military judge did not abuse her discretion, and this court should affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal? And I believe you had a number of, if you would begin with the issues that you reserved to discuss on rebuttal, please.
Yes, Your Honor. In response to Judge Baker's question about the statement that he was leaving his kids behind and it being evidence and aggravation, after thinking about it a little, that would appear to be a collateral consequence of the conviction and not directly relating to the offense as it is delineated in RCM 1001 and discussed in United States versus Hardison, a direct consequence of the offenses that he committed. That would seem to be a collateral consequence of the sentence that he received. And after considering Judge Efron's question about the admissibility and whether or not it's permissible for an appellate court to use the evidence for a separate purpose than the military judge considered it for, it would appear that a CCA, under Edwards, there's a rule that states if it's admissible, inadmissible under one rule doesn't mean that it's not admissible under another. If this court were to find that it were admissible under a separate rationale, i.e. evidence and aggravation, as opposed to the evidence of rehabilitative potential the military judge admitted it for, and do as the CCA did and stated it was clearly evidence and aggravation, Pound's argument is that would not be appropriate because the judge clearly considered it for evidence and rehabilitative potential, not for evidence and aggravation. And in that regard, affected the sentence that she gave the appellant at that time.
The government has cited and relied on the Gogas case in response to the same question. Is there any way to distinguish Gogas from the case now before us?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe in Gogas, the particular evidence that was in aggravation, the court said that those were statements that proposed an indifference to the nature of the consequences. But we don't have an indifference in this letter. This letter, and specifically the narrowed down paragraph that is of contention here, is not an indifference to the offense.
But why is that? Why is that distinction important? That is, in that case, isn't it the same underlying concept that evidence introduced for one purpose can be used on appeal to affirm for another purpose? Does Gogas stand for that proposition or not?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And in this case, the evidence doesn't directly relate to the offense. This letter does not directly relate to the offenses committed. It doesn't express any emotion about at the time he committed the offense, what were his motivations, what was his understanding, how he felt about committing those offenses.
Leaving aside the probative value of the letter, doesn't Article 66 basically say that CCAs can do what they please? They're supposed to conduct an independent review of the record, and they have fact-finding power. Can't they use evidence A for purpose B, even though the military judge admitted it for A under Article 66?
Yes, Your Honor, under Article 66, they do have that fact-finding power.
And they're supposed to conduct an independent review of the whole record.
Yes, Your Honor.
So,
in this case, even in light of the Article 66 fact-finding power, the letter doesn't change. This letter does not directly relate to the offenses. And the only line we have from the CCA is that clearly it's evidence in aggravation. That's it.
So what you're saying really is military judge erred on one ground, CCA erred on another ground. It's error. CAF, do something about it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you for that excellent summary, and if there are any questions, I will conclude. Appellant respectfully requests that this court set aside the sentence.
Thank you, counsel. This case is now submitted. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today, and the court will be in recess until 10:20 a.m.